Welcome back to Rhetoric Warriors, the podcast. We are evangelizing about persuasion. That's what this is. It's a persuasion evangel. Complicated world out there. Got to learn some stuff if you want to be effective. So we're going to try to do that once again here. I'm Dr. Dan, late night comedy writer, rhetorician, PhD in rhetoric, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. On the podcast, I talk to comedians about their politics because that's always fun. I convert people from their political perspectives to a new one. I don't know which one exactly. I don't care. I just want to move them around. And I talk to persuasion pros and rhetoricians, more rhetoricians on my podcast than any other podcast you're going to hear today. That's a promise. This is another episode of Persuasion Pros. This is where I grab interesting non-rhetoricians out in the world and explain to them that they actually may be rhetoricians. They just don't identify correctly yet. So these are people who do persuasion of some type for a living, have some interesting perspectives on it. And I keep running into people on Lunch Club, which has been super fun, and them wanting to drag them onto the podcast because I find them to be interesting people and they're doing something I think that has some value for understanding persuasion. So my guest today runs Black Bean Marketing, which is a B2B digital marketing agency in British Columbia for manufacturers, which means she's a strong woman in a male-dominated industry. Also graphic designer background. She does some charity work. She's a mom. And maybe the most multicultural background I think I've run across in a while. There was Haiti in there, Switzerland, Germany, China. We're going to talk about all this. Laura Norup Boyer, right?
Correct.
You had like four different names online.
I got married one time too many.
Yeah, it happens.
It happens to the best of us.
So one time too many, like, is this like six times or is this?
Twice. I feel like they should tell you younger women before they get married the first time, don't change your name. It's too much hassle. It's not worth it. Just stick with your original name.
Yeah, my ex didn't change her name. She just kept the same name. But now both my kids have my name and not her name because her name was really boring. And my daughter's name is Quincy and my ex's last name was Jones. And no way we were going to name her Quincy Jones.
Why not?
It's just a little too much heritage, a little too much to deal with going around being Quincy Jones for everybody.
But think of all the restaurant reservations you could have gotten. Hi, yeah. I'm Quincy Jones.
That is so true. I didn't think about that. Yeah, you should name your kids something awesome so they can get into restaurants. So, yeah, we met on Lunch Club and you were like, why do you want me to podcast? And I'm like, because you're interesting.
You're my first.
This is the first podcast, really?
I am a podcast virgin.
Wow. This is going to launch a new career for you that you just will not believe. So run your background for people a little bit because it is sort of a unique tapestry kind of background.
Sure. I have a feeling it's a pretty standard European background, but maybe for North Americans, not so much. I was born in Switzerland of a Haitian-born New York emigrated mother and a Swiss father. I spent the earlier years of my life between Brooklyn, New York, with my Haitian Jamaican family and my Swiss family in the US, in Switzerland, sorry. And yeah,
you can't even keep it straight. You don't even know.
I know.
Where you've been, who you
went to. I went to elementary school in French and then middle and high school in German because I'm from a part of Switzerland that is a bilingual state. So we can just seamlessly go in between languages. Both languages are within the same school, so we can just naturally transition. Also in Switzerland, you cannot find a job if you don't know at least one of the other official languages. There are four of them, so you have to have one or other. If not, forget about getting a job. So a lot of parents will put their kids, you know, in one of those kind of dual bilingual institutions. Anyway, so I did that. Then met my first Danish husband, who was on his way to Singapore. And I thought, hey, that's fun. I'll tag along. Moved to Singapore, lived there for a bit, then moved to Shanghai, China. Worked there for about 3-4 years. Loved it. So much fun. It was the Wild West. They were just hiring a bunch of 20-year-old hooligans like myself who had just freshly graduated from university and giving them insane job responsibilities. It was the best time. And after a few years, we moved down to Hong Kong because we wanted more greenery. And Hong Kong's actually got a lot of national parks. So we went to live in the middle of the jungle in Hong Kong, where I got attacked by wild boars and
see, this can't be just standard every European.
It's funny.
Gets attacked by wild boars in
Hong Kong. I got bitten by a snake when I was pregnant. That was just outside my door. That was funny. Anyway, so did that for a while. Then upgraded husbands. Married a lovely Canadian man who, after a few years, we decided to move to Canada to raise all of the children we had together. And that's where I've been for 6 years now, running Black Bean, which, as you said, is an industrial marketing firm specialized in manufacturers, helping manufacturers kind of market their services and broadcast their messages.
Okay, so let's finish out. Let's explore a little bit this cultural background, then we'll get to your business background. So what were the, there are four languages in Switzerland. What are they?
French, German, Italian, and then a very obscure language that no one knows called Romance. And I think there must be about 200 people who speak it, but it made its way into the official languages.
Interesting. How did it do that?
I think it was one of the founding languages of Switzerland. So it's also actually from the region where the World Economic Forum is held every year, Davos. So only in that tiny state do they speak that language.
Interesting. So English is not in there.
No, but my mom raised us in English. So I still have an accent, but I get bad in English.
Well, what is your accent? What language is your accent in?
I'm guessing it's a healthy base of French with a sprinkling of New Yorker. And probably some international accents of living in Hong Kong for about 10 years, which is a very British English over there. It took me a while to stop saying lift and start saying elevator, things like that.
So you are your own dialect, I assume. Like, you've got to be the only person that's been that exact sort of linguistic process through all those different cultures. You're probably your own dialect. Congratulations, you've achieved.
Thank you very much. I've achieved dialect status.
Yeah, I went to school in Ohio and I grew up in Kentucky. And Kentucky's on the border of the South. And some people from Kentucky sound very Southern and some sound very Midwestern. And I'm probably 90% Midwestern, but I have a couple of vowels like I's that I can't really get rid of. So I still say like I every once in a while or bye, you know, stuff like that. And people just look at me like, where'd that come from? Like, I don't know. It's just stuck. That one vowel sound is stuck. So we're all kind of vagabondy with language these days. It seems like my daughter is in France right now. And she just interviewed last week for a job teaching little kids English.
Oh, nice.
So that she can stay there for another year. But so who knows how she's from Texas and California. And they're going to get that accent now to some French kids. And that's going to be inherited.
Actually, my kids are growing up with a French Canadian accent, which is keeping me up at night because it's so god awful.
That's funny. Yeah. Okay. So cool. Yeah. Background. You got a big culture background there. The Haiti thing I thought was kind of interesting. So is that like French Haiti? Is that like Haiti?
It is. Well, Haiti is Haiti. It was colonized by the French.
Right.
It was also the first country in the world to get rid of their colonizer. One might argue maybe a bit too early, given the state of the country ever since. So my mother was raised in Creole, which she still spoke at home with her sisters, hoping we wouldn't understand it. But it's a mix of French and the native language and some African dialects. So we can understand enough that she was not safe. So she was raised in Creole and French. But anyone who has immigrated will know that when you arrive into a new country, especially as a child, you try so hard to fit in. You don't want to ask any teenagers. They don't want to stand out. They don't want to arrive with a heavy accent. They don't want to arrive and say, you know, like, oh, I speak French and Creole at home. So she got rid of all of the French and really focused on learning English and focusing on that because she was going to be American going forward. Fast forward 20 years for her, and she marries a Swiss guy and lands in a French-speaking city. And she had to go back to, I think it was night classes, to relearn the French she had let go in her youth.
Right. Yeah. My daughter was in the French immersion school in LA for 2 years and was completely fluent. And then we moved to Texas and she went to public schools here and it just evaporated. So she's got a perfect French accent and no French, you know, actual understanding of what she's saying. So it's been interesting for her going to France for a year and kind of in some ways she avoids some of the judgment because she's got a good accent.
Yeah.
You know? But then people,
but French people will like judge French. Regardless. French people are always looking for a reason to judge.
So you talked about some strategies you have for like integrating your kids because you've had so much immigration experience and you understand the kind of process. And this is why I said like a lot of times people don't self-identify as rhetoricians. But a rhetorician is somebody who hyper designs messages and structures so that they can succeed in situations. And a lot of people do that naturally. And we were talking, that's one of the reasons I was like, oh, she'd be interesting to talk to about this. Because you've developed strategies and tactics for getting your kids up to speed in cultural transitions.
And yourself. And myself, to be honest. Yeah. Because we moved so often and through wildly different cultures. Between the European culture and, you know, the Asian culture and now North American culture, I almost have a little checklist of the how to assimilate 101 checklist.
That's perfectly rhetorical. That is rhetorician 101 checklist.
There you go. I think it was more prominent when we moved from Hong Kong to Canada because the children were older. And I thought you need to have a common understanding with the people you're going to grow up here with here in your new country. So for my kids, it's like, okay, every single Canadian at least knows how to skate. So you are all going into skating lessons so that one day you don't feel alienated when there's a game of pickup hockey that develops on the frozen ponds or on the dead end streets. I want you to be able to pick up that stick and know how to handle it. Or at least to have a common knowledge, a shared experience. That was one of the big ones that we did. There were others such as, let's see now, football, actually, American football.
Oh, yeah?
Understanding the rules of it. I forced them to sit through two entire seasons of the NFL.
How did that go over?
Good. I've created monsters. I now have a quarterback in my house.
Nice.
And everyone's glued to the TV from September to the first Sunday of February.
You know, it's fascinating how, like, I watch golf sometimes on Sundays, and my kids are like, you've never played. I've played golf like twice in my life. And I'm like, it's just on in the background while I'm working. But they produce it so well. The stories are so well done. The production level of the video and the images, like they can track a ball going in the middle, you know, the air. It's just so cool to watch. That's, for some reason, it's comforting to me.
It's just good background noise. Golf is not exactly going to be thrilling or exciting. No offense to all the golfers.
It's got its drama, but they have so many techniques for telling the stories of bringing you in. Yeah. And football, they're amazing with it, you know, and it's so spectacular. There's so many things to look at that.
Yeah. So took them to hockey games, took them to football games, took them to every single Canadian-like event, taught them how to ride a dirt bike. And these are kids to like mega cities, like Asian mega city. My older kids didn't even know how to use a dishwasher. We didn't have a dishwasher. Dishwashers don't exist in Asia. There's a very cheaply paid person who comes and washes your That's dishes. Funny. That's how it is. So I had to laminate sheets. I'm like, here's how you become independent. It was fun. Took them camping, you know, all, and I hate camping. But I figured that's on my checklist of how to assimilate in a new country where you can't swing a dead dog without hitting a camper. So,
yeah, that's very, no, again, that's very rhetorical of you. You're very organized. You're like, we got to hit all the different things. Otherwise you're going to be illiterate in this culture. And that's a handicap, right?
Yeah.
So good for you, Mom.
Thank you. They've assimilated really well. So I'm happy with that.
Yeah, well, I took my kids back to Kentucky a couple years ago and for some family event. And it was the first time they'd ever seen their extended family. Mm-hmm. Like the uncles and aunts, the uneducated mass that is my background family. And they looked at me like, what the? And I'm like, yeah, I could have raised you here. I could have kept you here.
They dodged the bullet. They dodged the bullet.
I chose to pull the family line out of this culture and drop it somewhere else. But so, yeah, that's a real thing. Okay, cool. So talk about your professional stuff. So you've also done a bunch of different stuff professionally. You started as a graphic designer. Is that right?
No, not at all. I started in waste management.
What?
Someone was talking to me about the other day about my professional journey. And I was like, it's not a journey. It looks like the British Columbia wildfire map. It's all over the place. So I didn't want to become a graphic designer straight out of high school. That's what I wanted to do. My father, who I believe was really well-intentioned, told me I would never be able to find a job as a graphic designer. That was before the explosion of you know, social media and everything going digital. And at the time, graphic designers were still in studios doing hand typography posters. And so he told me I'd never be able to find a job. I was much better off going into political science, because you could become a history teacher, you could become a journalist, you could become a lot of different things. So that's what I did. I went through political science and graduated with a master's in environmental policy.
Really?
My thesis, yeah. And my thesis was on municipal waste management.
So you were at the, you were in the sexy kind of cool part of political science. Ooh.
I was so cool. I had to fight off the boys for this thing.
Miss Waste Management, 1999.
Yeah, Miss Waste Management. It was interesting, though, because Switzerland recycles 95% of its waste. And my thesis was comparing Switzerland to China, and China is an emergent market that was still under the Kyoto Protocol. I assume you've heard of it. It was still cataloged as an Annex One country, meaning they were still in development and they didn't have to abide by the Kyoto Protocol. But they were producing so much and getting, you know, so much more developed at such a quick pace that they were starting to need a lot more waste management technologies. So that's why I originally went to Shanghai, and I was doing research for Swiss companies wanting to bring all of that recycling technology to Shanghai. And Shanghai was just a few years out of having the Universal Expo. So they really had to make an effort because so many international visitors would be coming and looking at them and examining. So that's what I did. But it turns out that the Chinese communist government doesn't really like you digging into their trash, literally. Part of my research was to follow a garbage truck on my bicycle all day long because I wanted to see what were they doing with that trash. They didn't like that at all. So after a few late night visits from the police knocking on my door, trying to get me to stop to follow the garbage trucks around, I pivoted and went to work for the Swiss Chamber of Commerce as their marketing manager there. And I kind of stayed in that marketing and events space for all of my career in Asia, so spanning 10 years. And after moving to Canada, I didn't have the right to work yet. I had to wait for my visa to allow me to work. So I thought, hey, I've got nothing to do. My kids are in school. My husband is newly retired. It's the time for me to get the hell out of the house. I went and did a degree in graphic design after all of those years.
Oh, okay. And,
that's how I ended up here.
Nice. So yeah, you have had the, sometimes it's the lily pad of jumping here and here and here, and then it all kind of comes together and you, in some ways, drag all that experience into the moment.
Exactly.
So that's an interesting story about the waste management. When you when you move across cultures again, I think you get these weird experiences for even business, right? That you don't, you never factor in what you're going to have to factor in.
Yeah. And you tend to just take whatever is offered to you. Like, hey, sure, I'll try that. You don't really have a career path, especially as an expat, because you don't know how long you're going to be in the country. So you take whatever seems interesting at the time and you'll see where it takes you.
So, okay. So talk about your stuff now. When did you start Black Bean Marketing? And that's also, again, talking about moving to different worlds and having to adjust real quickly. Like you said, manufacturing and marketing and manufacturing is a, that's been there for a while. That's a pretty hardened culture.
It is. So when I show up wearing a headscarf and bright red lipstick, it's going against what they expect.
Sure.
I started Black Bean 5 years ago. We started as a very kind of all-service generalist agency. And a few months ago, I think it was beginning, end of 2020, we started deciding, you know, who are we doing our best work for? Who do we have the most impact? Where do we have fun also as an agency? And as we audited all the clients, it became apparent that it was really what you would call traditionally blue collars. So trades, home service contractors, manufacturing, biotech, agrotech. And a lot of that has to do with communication. I don't have much of a filter. and I feel that that's very straightforward, no frill communication is very, very effective with decision makers in those industrial businesses. I don't have to get frilly. I don't have to become someone I am not in order to have very effective communication. So that's
so you've got the communication pattern, just not the right, it's not in the right person. Like they don't expect it in this person.
I think it's the unexpected that they like.
I would think so.
Nice surprise. Yeah. And I think I was telling you when we were speaking on Lunch Club, my gender is actually, it acts as a filter for, I think I called them for sexist morons. So if someone lands on our website and sees my face and I thought, oh, hell no, I'm not going to work with a woman, I'm dodging a bullet.
Yeah. It's a qualifier, right? You don't have to talk to those people. They self-select out. Well, so talk about that. Talk about some of your experiences with, because we talked about this a little bit when you look at the manufacturing industry and what's changing over time, you know, new generation coming in, and that you're in some ways better set up for that transition, you know, to service that new guild or that new slice of family owning the business than the older white guys.
Oh, you mean my boomer dad story?
Yeah, just talk about some of that. Sure.
Very often those companies will have been set up in the 70s, 80s, sometimes earlier, typically by a man, as it happened to be back in the day. And as the company grows and evolves, and the founder, who's very often still a founder operator, is starting to bring in their adult children or the next generation to prep them to taking over the company. We see that time and time again. It's really generational ownership in those businesses that's predominant. Now, the Gen X child, or sometimes even millennial child that's coming up the rank, is going to want to prove themselves. They understand that there has been a real digital transformation, and that the way that business was typically done of, you know, giving business to your buddy Bob down the road and sealing everything on a handshake and just relying on word of mouth and good reputation is not going to work going forward. Competition has gotten a lot more aggressive. It's all about metrics. It's all about messaging, thought leadership being just out there in the digital world. So very often that next generation is the one who starts talking with me and who sees, okay, this person, this woman, this agency, they are doing things differently. They look differently. They act differently. And they will help me disrupt and adapt more so maybe than an older agency owner who is in that same mindset of let's just do things the old fashioned way. It's just bringing in fresh blood, I guess.
Yeah, and I've experienced this a lot in doing digital marketing here for the last 5 years. The audit thing that's on your website about coming in first and auditing, you know, somebody's funnel and all their different things that they've got going. I've argued for people forever, like there's only two things you need to really do in marketing. And I call it DQ and UQs. So what are your disqualifiers? Like when people land, what are they lowering you on? And up qualifiers are when they land, what are they bringing you up on? And this is how people scan messaging when they first arrive, and they scan companies and people and everything else. So like your, you know, red lipstick, is that a DQ or a UQ? So for, I would assume for like younger generation, like for people that like, you know, sort of more vivaciousness in their marketing and their business and stuff like that, that's a UQ, right? It's something that people focus on, they can remember. For people that are more conservative or things like that, maybe they disqualify you for that. So finding that stuff in your marketing and in your, all your messaging, you can't really do it internally. You have to have somebody coming in outside and taking a look at it and with sort of those kind of fresh eyes.
And you have to be okay with finding the right fit for your services. It's not only about, you know what, we'll just take whatever comes. It has to be the right fit, because that's the only way you're going to be able to serve them the best you can.
Do you find you've got to do, like I have to do so much massaging of clients to get them to accept my evaluation?
Oh my God. Yes. I was actually on the call the other day with someone. We always go in and establish a baseline. So we implement all of our analytics and tracking tools and everything. We just come in with all our little bots, and so we let that run for almost a month of gathering data, and then we start devising a strategy. And someone told me, I just don't see the value in it. Like, how do I sell, you know, the value of gathering data before going into a strategy so you don't go in blind? So that was a lot of massaging, a lot of education too. I find very often, and you might have that whenever you try to convert politicians, a lot of the pushback, a lot of, you know, digging your heels in is actually due to a lack of understanding, a lack of education. So I really see it as part of our mandate to first really educate, to not use any acronyms, to really just explain things the way they are, and not use all of that marketing jargon that actually tends to alienate people, because if they don't understand it, they'll feel stupid or uneducated, and that's never a good reaction to provoke in anyone.
Yeah, although I use this strategically all the time, like even just calling things rhetoric. Like the fact that I have a PhD in rhetoric and people don't even know what rhetoric is, they're like, what does that mean? And if I can get them into a state of curiosity, and in some ways, a little bit of a state of information submissiveness, where they'll actually listen, they'll learn, like, because so many people, I was just on a lunch club call before this, and the guy I was talking to, kept micro lecturing me on things that I clearly already knew.
So he was mansplaining things to you?
He was so mansplaining me. And he was older. He was a little bit older than me. And so I guess he was like young mansplaining me or something. I don't know. But he was going on about this stuff. And I just kept looking at him. I almost said, dude, do you remember the start of this PhD in rhetoric? I clearly understand everything you're talking about. Hit me with something, you know, and your top end. Like he was telling me about social media. Like he was literally telling me about Vine and TikTok. And I'm like, yeah, I've seen them. I was kind of there. So with that kind of stuff, like getting people into a space, and you do it, you know, not in an abrupt or a violent, you know, verbally violent way, but getting into a space to accept education.
Yeah, absolutely. You have to come at it very non-confrontational, especially as a woman. I mean, you've heard that before, you know, like a woman who's assertive is a bitch. A woman who is strong is bossy. So I really have to keep that very direct messaging, but soften it, at least in the earlier rounds of massaging a client, as you call it.
Yeah, and that, I use humor for a lot of that stuff.
Yeah.
It's kind of one of my natural go-tos even as a rhetorical tool. I've used it with my kids forever. I soften everything with humor. Like I used to threaten my kids when they were little all the time with punishments that could never be implemented. Like I told my son once, I'm like,
please, I need an example.
Like, if you do that again, I'm going to put you on the roof. And he's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, well, that's what they did when I was growing up, like in my neighborhood, bad kids, that they would get put on the roof and they'd have to sit up there for a few hours. And then when the dads came home at night after working, they would see what all the, who had been bad. By driving,
such a great visual. I have the feeling that's the beginning of a great kids book or shorts animated video.
Yeah, it sounds like a good one. But he'd look at me like, is that, are you?
He couldn't figure it out.
It lives on in their heads if you do it correctly, so that they get the message of you could be punished for this particular behavior without actually having to punish them.
Yeah.
So
I might try that.
Yeah, I did a lot of those. Those are fun. I used to tell him I was going to tie him to the tree out front. It's like,
I'm pretty sure that's been done before, though.
It I'm sure it has. It's probably all been done. You're always trying to control kids some way or another.
Probably some kid in the 70s or 80s got tied to a tree.
But my daughter used to ask me, I don't know if I told you a story when we talked before or not, but we were going to school one day and she was in high school and she was in the band and I asked her if she needed her clarinet and she's like, no, it's a B day. I don't need it today. I'm like, are you sure? She goes, yes. So we left it at home. Usually I just bring it anyway. But this one day we left it at home and halfway to driving her to school, she's like, oh. And I'm like, hey, what's O mean? Does O mean I need my clarinet? Because I'll bet you that's what it means. And I started to heckle her with comedy, telling, you know, just joking about, you know, how she went through this thought process. And she's like, can you just yell at me like a regular,
like a regular parent?
Yeah, because I'm really tired of this comedy punishment. I'm like, that's the point.
The point is to be annoying. It doesn't matter how. This is our goal as parents. We have to be as annoying as humanly possible.
Well, you have to have an emotional imprint so that they can remember it. And I don't want to use trauma and violence. Mm-hmm. So get comedy, you know, there you go. Or annoyance.
Annoyance. That works really, really well in my house. I steal my kids' clothes whenever they don't clean up their room. I just start wearing their clothes. And that is really annoying. Especially to my 11-year-old son, to have his mom walk around with his hoodies and go to work and be like, that's my kids' clothes. It's so embarrassing to him. It really works.
That's great. Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about. Yeah. See, you're a natural rhetorician. And I have a thing, persuasion for parents, like teaching parents all these different techniques because they run out of stuff so fast. I'm like, when I used to teach persuasion in universities, I'd always start the first day by asking who's planning on spanking their kids. And it's the United States. So 80% of them would raise their hands. And I'd be like, well, when are you going to stop? And like, what do you mean? I'm like, is it when they get big enough to hit you back? Is that when you're going to stop? So essentially, you're just saying that you've got enough physical power to, you know, hit this person. But when they get big enough, you have to stop. I said, why don't you get a little more sophisticated? You don't have to hit kids to control them or to influence them. And they're like, well, so I started teaching them techniques for doing that stuff.
But don't you think that a lot of it has to do with individual personalities?
Sure.
But so I mean, if you didn't have a great sense of humor, let's just say you have zero sense of humor. Okay.
Let's say that.
Dust.
Let's say that.
Yeah. You couldn't have used that to annoy your children and teach them consequences.
No, I would have to use a different technique.
So I guess it's about finding what is in you the most efficient technique without resorting to, you know, physical punishment.
Yeah. And that's sort of the nature of rhetoric. Like the book that I published a month ago is called 21 Colosseums of Persuasion. Because it's essentially that theory that you lose in persuasion when you run out of options. And so everybody has like a limited set of options. Everybody wants to get into logic and argument, which breaks almost instantly. Like it's a horrible form of communication for human beings. And so then they're just like, well, this person can't be persuaded. I'm like, there's a lot of other options here. And you have to figure out what you're good at. And maybe sometimes if this person will react well to something that you're not good at, then you have to get good at it.
Become good at it.
But yeah, you have to figure out what they need and you have to hit those notes.
Yeah.
I'm sure your kids like, right? You probably work with your kids differently.
I do. Different things work on different kids. My husband's also very good at doing that. I don't know how to explain it. It's more he works on the disappointment. He somehow got all the kids to, the thing they fear the most is to actually disappoint him. I guess it's by setting extremely high standards. I don't know what the deal is, but they will just completely fall apart if they feel that they've disappointed him.
Yeah, those are
not tough. The same with me. Not the same with me. Apparently, they don't have a single problem disappointing me.
Let's disappoint mom for fun.
Just another day at the office.
So I, you know, like those techniques, I grew up in a Catholic family and there was sort of some guilt usage.
Yikes.
You know, and like I became immune to it because I'm like, it's not to me, like, especially with kids, those things are unfair, like embarrassment and shame and guilt. Those are too intense emotionally for most kids. They leave too much.
Are you saying I have to stop wearing the hoodies?
No, I think that's perfect because it's funny. You know, it's not actually traumatic. Yeah. Anything like that where you can get the sort of light version of that emotion to them is I like it. But I like funny.
Seeing the evolution of it, especially through my family. I'm probably going to throw my grandfather under the bus, but he's long dead. So let's go.
Dead grandfather under the bus. I think I've got the title for this episode.
Let's throw dead grandpa under the bus. Coming from Haiti in the 20s and immigrating to New York, I feel there was a lot of stress being placed, especially for, you know, people who are fresh off the boat, so to speak. And so his way of disciplining his children, all four of his daughters, was very, very, very physical. When you know, like belts or kneeling on dried rice, holding the Bible at arm's length, that kind of, there was that.
How do they come up with this stuff?
Like I don't that know. One. They get real creative. So my mom and her sisters were subjected to quite a lot of those pretty brutal physical punishments. And then it got lighter with her parenting. We were still in the generation that got spanked and sometimes slapped. And now into my generation, I would never dream of raising a hand on my children ever.
Yeah, right. I mean,
so I think it gets like there's an evolution. There's like an awareness that happens about what you are provoking and the effects and the long-term effects as well. And I'm hoping at least that it's just getting better with each generation.
Yeah, I think that's the notion of sophistication, right? When you are educated that there are other options that will work. I think most people go to something like And they all have the same thought, like you can't persuade kids with logic or talk or things like that. I'm like, that just means you haven't figured out how to do that. And yeah, you can hit somebody, you can hit a dog, you can hit anything, and it'll be like, no, I guess I'll stay away from that. You know, it's a pretty simple system, but doing it with human beings, yeah, has all sorts of repercussions that you probably don't want for that human being.
Yeah. Like it even also using, assumes that you, yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, even using command and control, like I never told my kids no. I never told them what they had to do. I never gave them commands. I never did any of that. Because
really?
Because those things stop discussion.
Hmm.
They start arguments, but they stop discussion.
All right. Well, maybe I'll go and read your book.
Yeah. The whole thing of like teaching kids, and you see some of this that will get its way into child psychology. That's why I said really like so many occupations and so many areas went in and just stole things from rhetoric, because rhetoric has been talking about this for a long time. Like in child psychology, you'll give your kids a range of choices, like either choose this or this. And that teaches them how to make a rational decision. It still gives them a border, so they're not going to go beyond that. And that's a rhetorical technique, you know, so you control the decision matrix, but they get power to choose within that matrix. So then they won't fight you because they have power. But if you just try to go big power over little power or no power, human beings don't like that.
It's actually very similar to what we do with prospective clients in our proposal process. You'll have a good, better, best option. And every time you just watch them pick the middle. And that's the one you wanted them to pick anyway.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. All those
people need to feel that they have, at the very least, the illusion of choice and freedom of this decision making.
Yeah, it's very interesting with that stuff with especially executives. Like I had to explain at some point, like I kept looking at, why is this breaking down? Why is this such a horrible process? Why is this so painful? Mm-hmm. And it's partly because in creative, there's so many sub decisions, right? There may be 500 sub decisions on the way to a block of copy, you know, yeah. What words, where does it go? All this stuff. And so you keep going back to the client and ask them for approval, and they're the least qualified people to make that decision. I'm like, that's a terrible system. It's going to fail. They're going to end up choosing the wrong things. So I end up doing a point and choose decision structure. Like, I'm going to show you the options between the two things, and all you got to do is pick the one you like. It doesn't mean it's going to end up there, but I need to take all the intellectual stuff out of it. And it just speeds things up. And they feel like they've still got power, but they don't screw up my process.
We started going through a process of making new clients go through a personality test.
Nice.
Which is unconventional.
You're targeting
it's very unconventional. I've been met with a few raised eyebrows. Communication, I mean, you know it, is the single point of breakdown in between people. So if we understand how best to communicate with a client, we can modify our messaging and our method to facilitate everything. So if everyone takes a personality test, oh, okay, they like to be in control. And we'll also say, you know, how do you respond best to feedback? Are you very visual? Can you actually imagine things in your head? We put them through this entire process that is then going to help us. Are you a texter? Are you an emailer? Do you prefer picking up the phone? So if we can tailor our communication to their personality, we're already ironing out a lot of kinks right there.
Yeah. And that again is perfectly rhetorical. Like, I need to know what you need to hear.
Yes.
What
and
I want
how
to
you need to hear it.
Yeah. What I want to say is immaterial. It makes no difference.
Yeah.
Like, as a rhetorician, I'm agnostic. But I need to know what's going to be most effective with you so that I can give you that, so that we can get to where I want you to go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, if you explained in the beginning, it's like, it's all for you.
I don't know. We probably should do that too, but I tend to just go in and kind of retrain everybody like to what they should do.
Yeah, but you're an expert. So you come with a position of authority.
Yeah, it's a cheat. It's one of the assets I have, but like I start with, But even like the Hollywood stuff, the fact that I was a Hollywood writer and I worked, you know, on late night TV shows and things like that, it gives you this air of super creativity.
Yeah.
So I can come in and a lot of times I tell executives, I'm like, you know, you all have SPS. And they're like, what's that? I'm like, that's smart person syndrome. And it gets in the way of CPS, which is creative person syndrome. Like smart people can understand creativity when they see it, but that doesn't mean you can do it. You can approximate it. What you want is some idiot that's just totally creative and is going to create this slogan or this story or character that you're like, oh my God, that's amazing. And like, yeah, if you talk to them, they're not very smart, but man, are they linguistic. And those are the people we need to pull in, and you just need to kind of get out of their way and let them do their crazy stuff. And
it's
you
hard to convince them to get out of the way. Just like, let me do my thing, man.
Yeah. But, you know, I think everybody logically understands the pitch of, hey, you know, if we're building a car, who in here knows how to build cars? Like, okay, well, you don't know how to build a car, so we're going to put you in charge of all the decisions. Does that sound like a good idea?
I'm going to use that.
Yeah, trying to figure out all those little stories and metaphors to help people quickly get to the lesson.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's effective. Like, I don't really think I'm great working with business people. I'm not the right guy. I can do relationship stuff and I can help them feel good about, you know, where they're going, and I can do good work. But typically it's better to have an account manager between me and most of them, just because, you know, there's all that servicing of their ego and like the thing you're talking about, the adjust to their psychology, which is super important in business, but it's not what I'm not interested in it.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I can't get away from it. That's one of the central tasks.
But you've developed your own little superpowers. It sounds like things that, you know, typically work, that you bring to the table and you're like, these typically work. I'm typically know it's going to be successful with a client.
Yeah. There is a lot of ego stroking though.
Well, again, that's sort of what you're talking about, you know, in the gender stuff, that I think that's one of the tools that, like, if I go in and do too much, you know, ego stroking with dudes, it doesn't,
But coming from me, it's flattering.
Yeah. You know, so it is interesting, even with my partner, who's also kind of an alpha male dude, you know, we'll be talking about stuff and like, we are not the right two people, even though we're the principals in the company. He gets hit with mansplaining, and I'm not sure he's a mansplainer, but he's really, I call him, I want him to start a consulting agency called Brutal Business Consulting.
Oh,
because he's just right at it. And he's a hardcore sales guy, and he finds out why, he looks very quickly about why your business is failing. Mm-hmm. And he's like, he's almost always on it. I'm like, and that's a superpower in itself. Like, people need that, but he doesn't present it with much ego stroke.
See, I have to wrap all of that. I get to the same conclusion, but I have to wrap it because, again, I have to be extremely aware of how my gender can be perceived. I think a lot of the perceptions are changing now, and that's great. But in dealing with, you know, businesses that have been established in the 70s, I have to be very careful about how I deliver. How do I wrap it up and package it? So it doesn't come across as belligerent.
So what are some of the sub tactics you notice yourself doing? I'd imagine you sort of ask a lot of
questions. You want me to spill all my secrets?
Just curious. Like, you don't have to give them all, but give us a couple.
A lot of repeating what they've just said to me. A lot of that. Actually, I had a case just yesterday where the client was kind of butting into the process a little bit too much. I guess at the same time, they were aware that maybe they were butting in, and had just had to go with like, thank you so much for your involvement, your commitment. It's very rare that we, you know, work with clients that are so committed to the success of the project. It feels great to know that we're not alone on this journey. As you've correctly noted yourself, we can sometimes run into a too many cook situation. So we'll just take that off your plate for now. But again, we couldn't have made it here without your help and your involvement.
That's
which is
good.
My polite way of saying, please get out of the way.
Oh, that's so funny. No, those are good techniques. One of the chapters in my book is, it's called interpersonal or relationship persuasion, but I call it nice suasion, where it's just all those interpersonal techniques that you're talking about that you have to drape all your messaging with those.
Yeah.
You know, and compliments like that are a strong one.
Yeah, especially, I guess, coming from a woman to a man, they get all flattered. They get like, ooh, she really appreciates everything I've done. That's the message that stays with them, not the whole, we're going to take over for now. But yeah, it's sometimes I don't want to do that. You know how sometimes you just get tired of convincing people? I see you nodding enthusiastically. Sometimes it's just really exhausting. But it's okay. I can go and I rant to my poor husband, and then I go back to work and I continue and I stay patient and understanding and non-threatening. That's a big one.
Yeah. The emotional work of all this stuff. I sometimes tell people really, I think the ultimate superpower in being persuasive is adjusting your own psyche. Because persuasion is not a lightning bolt that you say the perfect thing and just it all falls into place. It's a grind. It's winning every little centimeter of real estate with battles, you know, and it's exhausting.
Yeah.
That's why most people, like even in politics, they'll get a crazy relative or something that gets caught up in a extreme political viewpoint. And they just won't go over there and do any of that work because of dealing with all the explosiveness and all the, you know, extremeness and all the emotion that comes at them. So you end up just, you know, cutting that, walling that person off or avoiding those topics, which ends up bad because then you let them go be as crazy as they want to be when they, you know, vote. But it's, it's a real thing about, you know, having enough battery to be able to do persuasion.
Yeah. I think it's important to, when you're in a role like this, where you have to do a lot of convincing, to take a bit of time to not go and convince anyone. I think I got on the rant last week. I was just like, I'm tired of talking to people. I'm really tired of getting them on the path of what's best for them. I just want to go on a book and read a mindless beach read.
Yeah. All
that's
stuff.
All I wanted to do.
So are you an introvert or extrovert? Do you get drained
introvert.
By this stuff?
Yeah. Introvert. I'm a massive introvert. I'm what they call a social introvert. I'm not shy. You might have noticed.
No, you seem fine. You don't seem to be falling apart with every piece of
conversation. No, I can definitely. And I think a lot of that has to do with my background in events management. You have to be able to just activate it. You turn it on. For a very determined period of time, you give it everything you have, and then you have to shut it off and just go collapse on your own, hiding under a desk. And fortunately, I'm married to a true extrovert who really kind of gains a lot of energy from being with people. So yeah, it was a bit rocky when he invited 28 people to stay with us over the period of Christmas for a total of 3 weeks, 28 people in my house.
What?
Yeah, it did not go well.
What do you do with 28 people?
Well, in my case, there was a lot of hiding in my bathroom because that was the only place. I didn't have a mattress on the floor with some kind of relative sleeping on it.
Wow, that's insane. That's...
It was insane, yeah. But he really, a lot of people just derive a lot of energy, and those people are great at business development.
Yeah.
I'm actually taking him to Vegas next year. There's a big HVAC trade show happening in Vegas.
Ooh, that's exciting.
Actually, I'm one of the cool kids. So it's happening, and it's actually happening on my birthday. So we're going to Vegas for my birthday, but really I'm going to the trade show. And even though he's not employed in the company, I put him in charge of business development. I made him a bunch of business cards because he thrives on just talking to people all day long.
Yeah, those people are super necessary in business.
They're fantastic. They're such a great asset. And I'll do it for an hour or two, and then I'm whimpering in a corner.
You want to hear the story of the best biz dev person I ever saw?
Yes.
So I used to be, I've been a panelist down at the Austin Film Festival for years. And so they go around and get sponsorships from all the Austin businesses for the conference. It's a big screenwriters conference here. And so I was talking to a buddy of mine at one of the parties, and this woman started walking towards us, and she was in her early 20s and blonde and these big blue eyes and boobs like out to here. And just like, what's up with her? And she came right over and she knew my friend from the thing. And I started talking to her, and she had been hired by the festival to go around to all the businesses and mm-hmm. sell and get advertising and donations and all that. And she had worked downtown Austin on Segways, like doing Segway tours.
Okay. Yeah.
Like when you jump on the thing and just take people yes. around. And she had this Minnie Mouse voice. And so she was going around to businesses, pulling up with her big boobs and her blondness on a Segway to the front of the business. And she sold all of it, every single piece of advertising they had.
This really bubbly personality to just walk in there and never, go like, hi, y'all.
Yeah. And smart. Like, yeah. Just, I'm like, God, you are a super employee. You know, any business would need you. So, yeah, that kind of person, when you run into him, you're like, yeah, that's super valuable for a business.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't have my husband in my business. That would be a recipe for disaster. But for an HVAC conference in Vegas, sure.
Sure. Well, sure. It's weird too. Like when I did stand up for years and years as a pro stand up, and I have energy on stage, but I'm an introvert, you know, I'm not a super crazy bounce around the world performer, and people would come up to me, I'd be up there for an hour, and then I'd be in the back after the show at the bar, and people would come up and they'd be like, hey, you know, and they would expect that same character. And I'd be like, no, I'm done. I have no energy for you.
Now I'm back. Yeah. I've gotten depleted.
So, well, that's cool. So do you do the biz dev for your company then?
I have to. I don't have that position. It just works a lot better if I do it, I have found. Unfortunately, I just went and hired a whole bunch of introverts. So my entire staff is introverts.
That was not,
that was not well thought out. They are a fantastic strategists and, you know, analysts and developers. I am the most social person there is in the office. So I have to do it. I did hire even a business development coach to kind of help me out, also with automating, and just feel a lot of time a coach is someone who just holds you accountable.
Sure.
None of what they tell you is generally groundbreaking. It's just, hey, here's that thing that you've known all along, and I'm going to hold you accountable to it.
Yeah.
So that's what happened. It's going.
it's really, again, like I harvest from academics, and then I harvest from my Hollywood background. And the people that I know that have been super successful in Hollywood, they're salespeople. Like I got a buddy who's a producer, and he's produced some really big game shows, but he knew how to put together a presentation that would be so entertaining that a lot of times he sold shows that weren't great shows just because he was so good at entertaining them during the pitch. And like, he actually hired Carrot Top, you know, Carrot Top.
Yep.
He hired Carrot Top, paid him $10,000 to come in from Vegas. He knew him from the old days in stand-up. Because he knew the executive he was going to be talking to was a big Carrot Top fan. And so Carrot Top came in and did 10 minutes to open the pitch. You know, how do you do that? Like suddenly, like you got this guy, like you're now so wanting to buy his show because he's mm-hmm. so creative in the business development. So, you know, out there that he became kind of famous for his pitches in Hollywood.
People would just hire him to come and do pitches.
Yeah, but they didn't know what he was going to do.
People buy from people.
Cool.
Well, that's the thing. At the end of the day, we're all people trying to connect with other people. And in sales, people buy from people. That's all it is. I mean, sure, you can do a lot in terms of marketing, a lot of support, a lot of, you know, the right messaging. But when you sit down in front of another person, ask them to sign a contract, a six-figure contract, it's going to come down to who you are. If you're the service you're offering is fantastic, and it's exactly what you need, but you're a complete asshole, you're not making that sale.
Yeah, I would think you come across really well at that point. Like, you seem really solid. You seem like you see a lot of this stuff, but you also have a really solid business marketing sense. Like, you would want to deliver really good services. You have a good feel about that.
Thank you.
Is that another one of your superpowers? Like, you just seem like you're wanting to do good things.
I don't just seem. I legit want to do good
things. I didn't say you didn't. It's not an act.
No, I do. I do. I'm a bit of an overachiever. And so, and you know, in business, everyone knows that your reputation is everything. You can get by for a while with a crappy reputation if you have a great sales team that's just churning and burning. That's not how we do it. We have longer partnerships. It's just not just a 3 months engagement and then off you go. So we really are in it for the long haul, and we need to be able to deliver. And we can't stand the idea of letting anyone down, like, let alone the client. We just can't. That's not going to happen.
So over delivery, that's your...
on the promise, over deliver. Go in there and like, you know, I'm not sure how much we'll be able to move the needle, but let's try. Let's see what we can do.
Yeah, marketing's a bear, man. Like, moving needles in that world. Like, we had a client that... They were a pain management group, and they had sort of had a sweet business deal for a long time through a major university that gave them clients. Like, they were the referral source. So they didn't really realize that they didn't have a business. They just had a service, the university business.
Yeah.
And so something happened where that went away, and then they've hired us to now go out and market in the world against all these other pain management groups. And in a market where nobody knows them, they have no brand awareness, they have nothing. And they're like, how much do you think this will cost? And I'm like, how much do you have?
Yeah.
Because you're starting.
What is your business worth to you?
Yeah, it's amazing. Like, and they're doctors. It's like a consortium of five different doctors, and they make really good money and they've been successful, but they don't know what the pipeline, like that sort of super pipeline they've had. They don't know the value of what that actually was.
Mm-hmm. So now they have to go and build a pipeline.
Yeah. And you know, that's marketing, right? And all the different digital stuff that they suddenly have a new expense in their world. So it's interesting.
People tend to expect that you're going to change one thing and it's going to make drastic changes. And really it's a combination of several smaller things. So managing expectations is one of my, you know, among all the other jobs.
I was going to say, man, you've got lots of jobs going on.
I know, but it's the same as marketing. It's all those little pieces that you have to put together that is going to lead you towards success. It's not just one thing.
Yeah. Well, sounds like you're doing well. Sounds like you're doing good at these multiple things. So good for you. Good for Black Bean Marketing. Good for the daughter of Haitian Switzer. Like, there again, there's no category. I can't just call you.
No. So. But have you done one of those ancestry tests, DNA tests, which I find with a lot of African American people or descendants of slavery, like in my case, it's very powerful because we actually don't know. I can trace it all the way on my father's side. And they kind of stayed put for the past 30,000 years.
Right.
But on my mother's side, we didn't know. So I took a test and she was not happy with the results.
Really? What were the results?
We're from Cameroon originally. So I guess that's where it all started. But the family mythology was that they were from a very noble tribe in Senegal. I don't know where that started. So it was passed down generation from generation. We're from Senegal. And she went on a soul-searching journey to Senegal. She stayed there for 2 weeks. She went to the slave market that is still standing there. She stood at the harbor. There's even that picture of her watching, you know, the ocean, the Atlantic Ocean ahead of her, thinking, this is where my people were, and they survived on the boat for 40 days. Nope, Cameron.
The difference between story and science. There was a gap. Yeah, my son got a 23andMe and it came back. It just said, you're white. You're very, very white. You're very, very, very white.
You're white with a side of white.
I think the only thing we had maybe 5% Italian, like that was as exotic as we got. So
maybe that's where the rhetoric came from.
From the Italians, the Romans, maybe. Although the Romans stole most of their shit from the Greeks.
They did, but you know, Italians, they talk a lot.
That's true. They had some good, I mean, there's some good, good thinker writers back there for sure.
If you ever want to be entertained, you should watch actually Parliament Session, Italian Parliament Session.
Wow, very because they're high so animated.
Oh, it's wonderful. It's like Jerry Springer, but just make it politics.
That's great. Yeah, I don't know. You see some of that stuff starting to break into our politics now. Like nobody really understands that, like American politics with Trump. I'm like, yeah, the rest of the world's been dealing with this for a long time. It just never could get into American politics. And it kind of broke in, like, you know, the Berlusconi, what was the Italian?
Berlusconi. Yeah. Berlusconi.
You know, same kind of shit. I mean, this is Mussolini stuff. This has been around for 100 years and now, or 75 years, whatever. But it's now breaking into American politics. I'm like, yeah, learn to deal because it's not going away.
Yeah, I think now that they've seen the power of bringing entertainment in politics, that's not going to go away.
Yeah. Well, cool. I will let you, I've kept you over an hour. Super fun, like I expected it to be. you want to promote your stuff a little bit? Tell people how to go. Why should they go?
Oh God,
Black
I'm
Bean?
The worst. Don't ask
just
an
a little,
introvert.
Just a little. Just a little. Just say go to Black Bean if you're this kind of company or whatever.
Let's see. If you're
what do you mean you're not good at it? You're the business development.
But I'm more interested in the problems that those manufacturers have to solve. It's more of a, it's not about me. I really want to hear about you, which is genuine. And then let's see how I can help. Anyway, so if you are a biotech, agritech, or manufacturing company that wants to change things up a little, that needs to blow off the dust of your marketing and figure out exactly what's going on and how you can grow to the next level, you can go to blackbeanmarketing.com and learn more about our services and get in touch.
See, that was a perfectly viable pitch.
Yeah, I'm sweating profusely, but it's valuable.
Oh, that's so funny. Get your husband to write you a extroverted pitch and you just practice.
Oh my God, he'd be the best. He'd be out there going like, look, we're the best. Okay, you got a problem. We're definitely going to solve it. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. So you need those people too. Well, thanks again for jumping on this. Like I said, I like to find random people out in the world who seem interesting and you fit the bill. So I appreciate it.
Thank you. That was a lot of fun.
Okay. Well, we will circle back around sometime. This has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Get out there and persuade some people. They need it.